session number 13520, reel number 3.
Mr. Morgan, reel 3.
When Arnhem happened, I have no hesitation in saying that far and away, in my opinion, the most dangerous possibility was a real rift in between the Americans and the British. It was always there, just below the surface. How many more wars have we got to fight to save the bloody British Empire? That type of thing. And it was particularly so where American staff officers were of Irish-American origin. And there is no doubt whatever that Arnhem provided a classic example of where, under misinformed or wrong information, Arnhem could have been presented in American headquarters as a British box-up. But the fact that the maps in the American headquarters down to a divisional or corps or divisional level had the Arnhem operation developing under their eyes knocked that straight on the head. And I myself have actually seen two American staff officers standing in front of the map discussing the Arnhem situation in a totally sympathetic manner. And I would beg to think that was probably one of the most important actions that Phantom did in the entire war. It was nothing that we were the only form of communication left in the end to General Urquhart, as is well known, that he had no means of communicating with the Second Army except through Phantom at the end, and his famous last message saying that he could hold out no longer was a Phantom message. But that was splendid, and Phantom operating exactly as it should have done. But in the big picture, the fact that all this was relayed as a matter of routine to the Americans was immensely important, I think. And the other way round happened a few months later at the Ardennes. And there exists somewhere in the public record office all the Phantom messages collected together by one of our officers, Alistair McKinley, after the war, which shows the Ardennes offensive by the Germans beginning merely with a message of increased artillery activity. And through that, and through the operation of Phantom with the 101st Airborne Division, and right up in the Ardennes, the superior commanders from Eisenhower downwards had the Ardennes operation unfolding in front of them, literally minute by minute. And they were never in the slightest doubt as to what was happening. And for example, that the Montes moves to counteract the German offensive were taken in time, and the thing was reasonably under control. Almost, if we were going, now what would have happened if the fog of war had descended on the Ardennes at that time? All sorts of people would have been caught with their trousers down. But it didn't happen, because none of the commanders were in any doubt. And I think myself that those two instances are classic examples of what Phantom was able to achieve when it was operated properly. For myself, I think I've been frequently asked this, I think probably it will, that an organization like cancer will never exist again, because modern technology has overtaken it. The little that I understand about it would seem to me that it is very unlikely with modern technology that a modern commander will suffer from the fog of war as his predecessors did, and that the creation of a special unit to remove as much of the fog of war from a senior commander as possible will probably be no longer be necessary. Partly, I imagine, because the days of huge conscript armies and massive movements of millions of men could conceivably be over, and a return to a more highly professionalized, highly scientific approach would cause this sort of thing to be no longer necessary. I don't know.
Can we go back to picking up the course of your own personal...
Yes. It was my squadron that went to North Africa. But I was taken away from commanding it and made second in command of the regiment as a whole. And that was in 1943. The reason for it was this, that Colonel Hopkinson, the original creator of Phantom, had left for the Airborne Division, of which he became a brigadier, in 1941. And he'd been succeeded by Colonel Derek Hignett from Hussars, I think. I've forgotten which cavalry regiment. And Colonel Hignett was an extremely nice man, but he was the apotheosis of what I might call a reconnaissance idea, being a regular cavalry officer. And for reasons which I explained earlier in this recording, that was a line of development of Phantom which moved to a dead end, because it was difficult to justify the existence of Phantom, as I've explained, purely on reconnaissance terms. It could be done just as well by example Colonel Hignett's own regiment that he just left. And that became pretty clear after Phantom, for various reasons, was totally misused at Dieppe, at the raid on Dieppe, where it was shown to be superfluous, because it was being used entirely the wrong way. And consequently, after that, there was a change, and Colonel Hignett left. And his second in command, Major War, who had been with Phantom from the very beginning, was put in command of my squadron to go with First Army to North Africa, and I was made second in command of the regiment without any commanding officer, while they looked for somebody suitable. And after a little bit of time, they pitched on Colonel McIntosh, who was a yeomanry officer, Scott, from the Fife and Forfar Yeomanry, and a very good choice. He wasn't, as I indicated, a regular soldier. And he very rapidly appreciated the situation, and particularly when it came to the amalgamation with the J service, to which I've I mentioned. And I stayed as second in command with him right the way through until late in 1944, when I was taken away and sent to Italy to recreate, or to create for General Alexander and General Harding out of the squadron, the Phantom Squadron, which existed there, which was partly made up of bits of the First Army Squadron that had been left behind and partly bits from the that had been in Cairo, to create a second Phantom Regiment on the lines of what we had that were already done in Western Europe. And this I did, and I returned back to be second in command in Western Europe early in 1945, and then quite soon after that I was taken away again and sent out to Calcutta to General Oliver Leese with a view to creating a third Phantom Regiment designed for operation in the invasion of Japan. After I'd got that recently organized, I came back again and then succeeded Colonel McIntosh when he was demobbed as Colonel of the Phantom in Europe.
What was General Harding like to work
very good for? Very good, excellent. He got it in one, very good. And particularly, he showed that very quickly, because when there was the insurrection in Greece in 1944, the first thing he did was to take away a Phantom patrol, send it to Greece, operating directly to him, which it was an excellent example of exactly how Phantom should be used. For the purposes of a commander, it could do any. It was there simply to acquire whatever information was considered to be important by a particular individual. But an individual sufficiently far away as to be reasonably ill served by standard army communication.
You didn't visit Greece yourself?
No.
Who was in command of that Phantom unit in Greece?
I think his name is Shaw, if I remember right.
And Oliver Leese?
Yes, that was the, that of course never happened, because mercifully it was never required. But it would have been interesting if it had happened, because it was made very clear that the operation would consist of a large number of very small, relatively independent units, something quite different to anything that we'd experienced in Western Europe. Exactly how Phantom would have operated in that situation, I'm not too sure. But it was originally to be only one squadron. And that eventually turned into a number three GHQ liaison regiment, but organized on more or less orthodox lines. To what extent that would have been modified, I've no idea.
Now, you were in the occupation force in Germany after V-Day?
Yes, only for... I suppose that would have been from May until November in 45.
Where were you in Germany?
Bad Oeynhausen.
Where's that?
It was not all that far from Hanover. It was a typical small spa. And that But the phantom really had. I mean, it was really waiting to be demobbed. I mean, the operations had ceased, and consequently, there was no.
What were relations with the German civilians like at that time?
I'm tempted to say too good. That there was a non-fraternization ban, but I think it was more. it wasn't really all that well respected.
What did you think of the non-fraternization order yourself?
Personally, I saw no purpose in it. I'm ashamed to say, perhaps I shouldn't be, but I'm partially ashamed to say that throughout the entire war, I had come to have the most extraordinary respect for the German army, which I thought to be used for ill purposes. The most remarkably professional organization, and consequently I was interested to meet a German officer, even though they turned up trying to get jobs as cooks and washers up in our mess.
Did they get them?
I remember it very well. I had them in, and I think the chap thought he was going to be sent to a camp or something. But I said that it went completely against my grain to have a German major washing up in the mess. But if that was what he really wanted, I would agree to it. But he must clearly understand that I didn't think that was the way in which a major should be occupy his time. But if that was what he wanted, I wasn't going to stand in his way. But it wasn't in any way something which I'd thought up as something by way of putting him down or anything like that.
But he did the job anyway.
Oh, yes. He wanted to eat. And my wife, who was in the control commission at the time, has far better stories in that regard of the extent of the deprivation of the Germans than I have.
How did Phantom come to an end?
It came to an end by simply just being disbanded. Its functions were nominally taken over by a detachment, I think, of the Princess of Wales's Kensington Regiment. But it really... it had nothing to do. I mean, its value had it had done its work. There is one further instance that I'd like to put in of the use of a phantom unit for a specific small purpose. The British commanders were very interested in the junction between the American and Russian forces, and they were particularly interested, should, alas, anything go wrong, as to what exactly happened, and that we happened to have Brent Hutton Williams with the American Corps, whose advanced elements were going to meet the Russians. And thereby, Brent was able to be at the actual meeting and was able to tell, Montgomery and de Gangon exactly what had happened at the meeting and of the relationship that had been established in between the GIs and the Russian opposite numbers. And it is difficult to think of any other means by which a British presence could have been achieved at that low level, which after all was a couple of captains and a few soldiers. And if I may be permitted a wry comment, it was rather interesting to me that when, on whatever it was, the suitable anniversary of this meeting, the BBC chose to make a program about the meeting of the Russian and American armies, in spite of the fact that Brent Hutton Williams was alive and ready to cooperate, they refused to have anything to do with it.
Why should that have been?
Heaven alone knows. We tried hard enough, told them about it. I remember saying to them, but he was there. But it was the British man concerned, was all we got.
How did the GIs and the Red Army men?
Very well. Very well. Very well. And in fact, Stalin hadn't really got hold of them. I've had the opposite Russians to dinner in our mess. It was a great success. Except they were consumed formidable quantities of whiskey. But that was all stopped when Zhukov was taken away, and Stalin got a grip on it. But originally they were, in fact, that just as a tangent, I remember there was a Russian artillery general came to dinner with his members of his staff in our mess in Germany, and he very much interested me by telling me that he had fought against the Germans in the First World War in the Tsarist army, and that he said to me the German soldier of today is good, but he is not the man his father was. And I've never forgotten that.
Earlier on you were talking about the necessity when you were in the Ipswich area of getting the right kind of officer for Phantom.
Yes.
What was the right kind of officer?
The right kind of officer was highly intelligent, malleable type of chap who was capable of being taught to operate very much on his own as eyes and ears for his superior, and the type of chap who would never introduce into his reports ideas of his own or things which he thought were true and were not facts. And it was necessary to have a certain stability. I can think of certainly one Phantom officer who was, I haven't mentioned the Phantom unit which was operated by the SAS and was dropped in France. But he was operating with that particular unit, and got himself into terrible trouble with a girl, and really failed to do his stuff at all, but simply decamped, and was caught by the Americans, and handed back. Now that was the type of thing that you've got to watch out for, because the ordinary Phantom officer was very much on his own, and that it was perfectly possible for him to do very little. But we weeded out an awful a lot of the candidates. In fact, in the last year or more of the war, we had our own training unit at Richmond under its own command, which took in, we were always never short of people who wanted to join, but we didn't by any means accept everybody who came. And they were put through a training course, and those who were just who were not wanted were sent back to their regiments. So we had complete freedom of selection. And that we were reasonably correct, I think, is shown by the remarkable future activities of people who were in Phantom, which I would think is unique in any one unit.
If Fitzjapson's stability made him unsuitable, how was it that he hadn't been weeded out?
He got slipped through the net. I still don't understand it. It was one of those mysteries. There were mistakes possible anywhere, and this was one.
By the subsequent careers of the Phantom officers, you mean the outstanding achievement?
Oh yes,
some of them
absolutely astonishing. Yes. I mean, I don't know if you'd like me to
just mention a few. Yes.
Well, four members of British governments, one head of a Cambridge college, one commissioner of police, the Metropolitan Police, one world-famous film star, one successful playwright, one editor of a Sunday newspaper, more than one ambassador. That'll do if we're going on.